Let's go ahead and open up to. I have to tell you, we went to Pete Hedgepeth's visitation, and you know, we did the viewing, and there was something in his hand. I don't know whoever knows Pete. He's a railroad guy, and that was his career and in life for many years. And so I'm looking at it, and it was a boarding pass was in his hand, and it had the date of his death and the time of his death, and then it had for destination, it had glory. So it was, yeah, it was very, very cool. That was, it was very cool, yeah.
Arrival time immediate.
Yeah, arrival time immediate.
Yeah, that's pretty neat.
But yeah, it's been prayer for that family, you know. We were talking about how it's just such a mixed blessing when somebody passes, because you can't feel bad for the person who passes, but you do for the people who are remaining in the separation that occurs. And how that's kind of how death is. It's a sorrowful thing because of the separation, but it's a joyous thing for a believer because we go directly into the presence of God and all these problems that we have are gone. So, okay, let's go ahead and open up to Genesis. We'll go into chapter 13 today. Turn this on. Just a reminder, chapter 12 really began the second major section of Genesis, the section that deals with the patriarchs, with Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, and that goes through then the end of the book. So I was talking with Steve about what's one thing, you know, been studying through Genesis, what's like one key thing, you know, that I've picked up on that maybe I didn't before, and part of that is just the foundational nature of the first 11 chapters. You know, sometimes we kind of think the first 11 chapters are kind of like an introduction to the important part when we get to chapter 12. But the first 11 chapters of Genesis are central to everything, central to, you know, the creation, man being made in God's image, how sin happened, why we're in the mess we're in, and how we're going to get out of that. You know, that was all introduced back in Genesis chapter 3 with the promise of the coming deliverer. So now in chapter 12, we're going to shift gears here to focus on one family. Before chapter 12, God's dealing with the nation, with the world as a whole, all the nations and all the peoples. Now things are going to focus in on the line of promise on Abraham and his descendants. And in the first three verses of chapter 12, God makes an unconditional, one-sided, everlasting covenant with Abraham, establishing God's unique relationship with Israel, a relationship that abides and continues through today and will into the future. And again, he made some individual promises to Abraham, to Abram, and some national promises to his descendants. Again, we call this the Abrahamic covenant. And it includes land, seed, and blessing, kind of a nice way to summarize things. Some of these promises have been fulfilled, and either in part or in full, and some await a future fulfillment. And ultimately, it'll be fulfilled when a saved Israel enters the millennial kingdom upon Christ's return. And there's also, thankful for us, there's a universal portion of the Abrahamic covenant that includes blessing for all the families of the earth in verse 3. And one thing we didn't talk about a lot was, you know, we have to understand, just because I kind of assume everybody knows this, but, you know, we need to understand very clearly that, yes, we Gentiles, or, you know, salvation has been extended to Gentiles, but the church has not replaced Israel. Okay, God's plan for Israel is eternal. The church isn't qualified to be the means of fulfillment of the promises given by God to Abraham. Okay, and it's real important to remember that. You know, as we interpret the Bible literally, that's the conclusion that you have to come to, that Israel still exists and Israel will continue to exist, and God will fulfill all the promises he's made to the Jewish people literally. Again, the church does have a relationship to the Abrahamic covenant, but isn't the fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant. And again, that relationship is that we've graciously been allowed by God to participate in the universal blessing of redemption that comes with the Abrahamic covenant in verse 3. So again, that happens through a Jewish Messiah, you know, Jesus, born 2,000 years or so after the covenant was given. Okay, and then verse 4 through 9, again, just reviewing what we looked at last week, traces Abraham's journey from Haran in northern Mesopotamia to the land of Canaan. Remember, Abraham's called while he's down in Ur in southern Mesopotamia. He goes up to Haran in northern Mesopotamia, which is the route, kind of that Fertile Crescent route to get over to Canaan. And so then we see him after his dad dies in Haran. He is called again and leaves and goes to Shechem in the promised land, in the land of Canaan. And God appears to him and calls him, reiterates the promises. And so Abraham goes to Shechem, down to the promised land, 400, 500 miles or so. You know, it's didn't hop in the van with Tom driving to get there in a day or two. You know, we were talking, you know, a month and a half, 2 months to get from Haran down to Shechem. And it is one thing, you know, trying to put yourself in the historical context. You know, when we talk distances in the Bible, it's a lot different than talking distances today. So it's a major commitment to leave Haran and go to Shechem. And then he goes from Shechem, he builds an altar in Shechem in verse 6 and 7, and he goes down further south another 20 miles to Bethel and Ai in verse 8, where he calls upon, he builds another altar there. He calls upon the name of Yahweh, worships the Lord, and then he goes down to the Negev in verse 9. So kind of just traveling through this promised land that's his descendants will have by divine decree. Then in verse 10 through 20, we have kind of the unfortunate account of Abram's journey from Canaan to Egypt. And again, due to a famine, due to a drought. And again, Canaan would be dependent on rain for water. You know, Egypt had the Nile River, so they weren't dependent on rain. So there's a famine. He goes to Egypt. And that was probably all okay. You know, it's a natural response to famine. But he tells a lie to protect himself when he's in Egypt. He presents his beautiful and desirable wife as his sister to the Egyptians because he's afraid that, as kings did in that day, they find a beautiful woman and they want him for a wife. They kill the husband and take the woman for themselves. And he was afraid of that. So he tells this lie. And I like the way Gil put this. Gil in his book said, in his notes on Genesis 12, said, Abram, the great man of faith, who was willing to leave his homeland for an unknown land, and who was willing to trust God and the promises he made to him in the covenant, was not willing to trust God with his life while he was in Egypt. Remember, he'd left Ur, gone up to Haran, you know, traveled 1,100 miles without knowing exactly where he was going. And now all of a sudden he's fearful of that, you know, that the king of Egypt, the Pharaoh, is going to kill him. So he lapses in his faith here in Egypt. And despite this lapse of faith and this, you know, this lie that he's telling in verse 16, you know, despite the lie, Abram's blessed with herds of animals as well as servants. So again, that promise of blessing continues to unfold in Abram's life. You know, God fulfilling his plans and purposes, accomplishing his plans and purposes, even using the sinfulness of men to do that. Then in verse 17, Egypt's hit with a series of unexplained plagues. Okay, we don't know for sure what those plagues were, but that kind of prefigures what happens in the time of the Exodus, centuries in the future. And Pharaoh somehow, it doesn't say how, comes to understand that these plagues are a judgment because he took Abram's wife. So Pharaoh calls Abram and says, what in the world have you done? You know, why didn't you tell me she was your wife? And he's, in verse 18 through 20, you know, Abram is unceremoniously expelled from Egypt by Pharaoh. It's like, get out of here. Has an armed escort to the border. We don't want you here anymore. But in verse 20, he got to keep all that belonged to him. So all this wealth he had accumulated in Egypt, we see it spelled out in verse 16, he gets to keep in this expulsion order. So so that's where we left off last week. And we'll go ahead. Oh, I wanted to say, too, just thanks to Rob from last week. We had a conversation about the pyramids of Egypt. Like when Abram came to Egypt, what about the pyramids, you know? And just doing a little bit of research on that and some conversation. You know, the pyramids of Egypt would have predated Adam's journey there by at least several centuries. So they were there and functioning. And the Great Pyramid of Giza, because Rob's been there, it would be like, who here has been to Egypt? Yeah. Anybody else? Did you got to see the Great Pyramid and yeah, just how astounding the structure is.
We got to go into one too.
So awesome, yeah. Well, those would have been standing in Abraham's day. Probably 500 feet tall when they were originally built. They've shrunk so 50 stories, you know, building it without cranes or anything like that. Still don't quite understand exactly how they were able to build such massive structures back in that day. But, you know, big, huge, gigantic structure. And it's the only one, I thought this was interesting, it's the only one that you hear about the seven wonders of the ancient world. And the pyramids, the Great Pyramid of Giza, is the only one left standing. All the others have been destroyed and worn down and destroyed by earthquakes or fires or just gradual decay. But these pyramids would have dwarfed the ziggurats that Abram would have been familiar with in Mesopotamia, because the pyramids were built with stone. You know, the ziggurats in Mesopotamia, like we saw that back in the Tower of Babel, were built with mud baked bricks. So, and the pyramids in Egypt would have been at least 2 to 3 times as big as the pyramids. The pyramids would have been 2 to 3 times larger than the ziggurats in Mesopotamia. So just very astounding things that Abram would have seen when he was in Egypt. So. Yeah.
It was astounding.
Yeah, amazing how they built that. We could do a whole year on just excavations in the Promised Land and stuff. But that was a good to put in here. You know, Abraham saw all that, but his focus wasn't on the grandioseness of the Egyptian Empire, you know, the Egyptian kingdom. It was on God. And that's the story. So, okay, now we'll go into chapter 13. I kind of put an outline of the chapter up there, and I think we'll move through the whole chapter here today. So, verse 1. So, Abram went up from Egypt to the Negev, he and his wife and all that belonged to him, and Lot with him. Now, Abram was very rich in livestock, in silver, and in gold. He'd be rejoicing today at the price of gold and silver, which is really high, I hear. But so now this regrettable, you know, experience in Egypt's behind him. So he returns back into the Promised Land, returns back to Canaan, and is going to kind of make a new beginning as he gets there. And again, this material blessing reemphasized. He's, you know, God said he's going to bless him, and financially is one way that that happens. So the drought had apparently ended, so he was able to get back into Canaan, and was there was grazing land for his herds. So verse 3, and he went on his journey from the Negev as far as Bethel to the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Ai, to the place of the altar which he had made there formerly. And there Abram called upon the name of Yahweh. So here he's retracing his steps. You know, if you were here last week, that's exactly how he went down to Egypt, was through these places. Now he's coming back into Canaan, following his same steps through the Negev and Bethel and Ai, and he's going to end up then in Shechem again. But he calls, he calls upon the name of Yahweh. He worships the Lord through prayer and sacrifice. We talked about how that word for altar comes from the idea of sacrifice, and he's sacrificing and worshiping God for what God's done in his life. He's not distracted. I thought it was one interesting thing. He's not distracted by his wealth. This is a rich man. And what's he do? You know, he's not out spending his money partying. I mean, he's worshiping the Lord. He's giving the credit where the credit's due. Okay, verse 5. Now Lot, who was going with Abram, also had flocks and herds and tents. And the land could not sustain them while living together, for their possessions were so abundant that they were not able to live together. And there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. Now the Canaanite and the Perizzite were also living in the land. So again, this is the first of 3 Abram-Lot stories. They're not all, there's tension in each one of these episodes with Lot. Here we've got the land thing. And then in Genesis chapter 14, Lot's going to be captured by a coalition of kings, and Abram's going to have to rescue him. And then in chapter 18 and 19, we're going to have the judgment on Sodom, where Abram intervenes to save Lot. And it's just like in the flood, you know, the judgment in Sodom and Gomorrah. It's just like the flood. They're evil people. Everything's wiped out except for one family. It's going to be Lot and his family. So these two men, Lot, you know, Abram's nephew and Lot, they're together, but they're very wealthy. They have large herds, and there's not enough grazing ground if they stay together. So they're going to have to separate in order to have enough grazing ground for everybody. So there's strife then, or quarreling. It's also translated between the herdsmen of the uncle and the nephew. And then Judy asked a great question last week. I appreciate your guys' questions because it gets me focused on chasing rabbits. But Judy asked a great question, you know, should Abram have taken Lot with him to Canaan in the first place? And it, you know, it doesn't really say yes or no, but in chapter 12, verse 1, it says very clearly, leave. You know, you're to leave your country, your people, and your father's household. Lot was part of that household, and he didn't get left. So was that, you know, was that wrong? Was it not God's plan for Lot to go? And then, like we already talked about, each time Lot shows up in the story, there's a problem. So that may be another indication that Lot shouldn't have gone. And but then there's also the reasons that maybe it was okay for Lot to go, because Lot was fatherless. His dad had died. So that would be kind of like the cultural obligation. You know, he's taking his nephew with him. And there's no explicit rebuke for Lot going with him. So we don't really know. If I was going to take probably, I'd err a little bit on the side of he probably shouldn't have taken Lot. I mean, things would have unfolded different. I mean, obviously God's plan for him to take Lot, but probably that was a mistake in his decision-making at the beginning, not listening carefully to what the Lord had said very clearly to him. Okay, so then in verse 7, a reminder of the local inhabitants in that land, the Canaanites, who we've already talked about back in chapter 12, verse 6, the Canaanites were the inhabitants of the land of Canaan. And again, we spent a lot of time talking about the Canaanites back in chapter 10 in the Table of Nations, where Canaan, of course, was the son of the cursed son of Ham, the son of Noah, and spends a lot of time on the Canaanites in chapter 7. Back in chapter 10, listing 11 descendants of Canaan. And that's who's occupying the land at that time, the Canaanites. And also here we have added the Perizzites, and we'll talk about them again in chapter 15. There's some mystery about the Perizzites. We don't really know where they're from. There's not really a genealogy for the Perizzites, but they do show up in the land of Canaan as Genesis progresses. But again, their origin is uncertain. There is a thought, if you're reading some commentators, they'll say, well, the word Perizzite comes from a word meaning open region or hamlet, and is also translated rural. If you go over into Esther chapter 9, verse 19, the word for rural there is the same basic word we have translated Perizzite here. So it may have been that these weren't like a lineage of people, but rather they were the rural dwellers. So there were the Canaanites kind of living in the cities maybe, and the Perizzites were the Canaanites living in the rural areas. So it's just an idea that's kind of out there if you're reading any commentaries on Genesis. But the key idea here is that these original inhabitants in the land, they're probably using the best parts of the land for grazing their herds. So that kind of adds to Abram and Lot have to separate because they got to find good grazing land for both of their immense herds. So, someday Abram would be certain that these original inhabitants are going to be purged from the land. And again, that happens, you know, centuries later when Joshua invades finally after the slavery in Egypt. So verse 8, so Abram said to Lot, please let there be no strife between you and me, nor between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brothers. Is not the whole land before you? Please separate from me. If to the left, then I will go to the right, or if to the right, then I will go to the left. So again, Abram appeals, you know, to their family relationship. You know, we got to have peace. And probably another, you know, focus of that is, we're going to have a lot of enemies here in these Canaanites and these Perizzites. So as a family, we need to keep the peace in our family so that we can stand firm for the Lord. in this area. And he calls him his brother. Obviously, he's using brother. He's really, you know, his nephew. Calls him brother in the sense of relation and closeness. Like I might call, you know, Todd, you're my brother. Well, I know we're not genetically related in any way. But so that's the sense here, kind of using a broad term here for brother. And, you know, he proposes this resolution to keep the peace, you know, split the herds, and you can have first choice of where you want to go. And, you know, big change from what happened in Egypt, okay? Abram is maturing spiritually through this process. God has given him promises, but he knows God is a, you know, he means what he says. He's going to get this land, but whether if Lot chooses it, it's okay. You know, the Canaanites and Perizzites are there now. That's okay. God's going to bring to pass what he's promised, and the land will eventually be his. You know, God is sovereign and doesn't need our help. That was the lesson he learned from Egypt, where he was trying to protect his own life by telling a lie. Okay, verse 10. Then Lot lifted up his eyes and saw all the valley of the Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere. This was before Yahweh destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, so kind of looking forward to chapter 19. It's like the Garden of Eden, like the land of Egypt as you go to Zoar. So Lot chose for himself, verse 11, all the valley of the Jordan, and Lot journeyed eastward. Thus they separated from each other. Abram lived in the land of Canaan, while Lot lived in the cities of the valley and moved his tents as far as Sodom. So again, instead of deferring to his uncle, you know, you would think, okay, Uncle Abram, why don't you choose first? Okay, that's the right thing to do. But no, he takes a look and looks around, sees the best land, and that's what he took for himself. The lush land in the Jordan Valley. And if you have New King James or NIV, valley is translated plain. It can be either way. There'd be a plain in the valley, so there's no conflict there. So again, Lot lifted his eyes and chose. So it kind of reminds you of Eve in the garden. You know, she looked and she saw and she took, you know, and ate it. And same way with the sons of God in Genesis chapter 6, verse 2. You know, they saw the daughters of men were beautiful, and so they took, regardless of whether they should have or not, they took. And I like what Calvin said, our eyes are not to be trusted. In case you've never picked up on that in your lifetime, you know, don't trust your eyes. And, you know, to Lot, this looks like it'd be a great choice. Everything's well watered. It's like the Garden of Yahweh, the Garden of Eden. It's like Zoar, which would be a lush place in the Jordan Valley at the south end of the Dead Sea. So he makes a choice based on this selfishness and appearance alone. Yeah, no consideration for his uncle, no consideration for what this might entail in the future. But this choice of Lot proves to be a total disaster for him. And again, we'll get to that in chapter 18 and 19. So there's this friendly separation. Again, Abram settles in the land of Canaan, which is the promised land, the land he's been promised anyway. So he leads the focus here too is he leads a more detached rural life, not overly intertwined with the locals, while Lot settles in the cities of the Jordan Valley. And we'll talk more about that as we move on. But kind of the cluster of cities down at the end of the Dead Sea where Sodom and Gomorrah are. We talked a little bit about Admah and Zeboim in Genesis chapter 10, kind of in that general area. The Jordan Valley would extend from the Sea of Galilee in the north through the Dead Sea in the south, and these cities would be clustered around the eastern side, southern side of the Dead Sea. So he becomes a city dweller, and eventually he settles in Sodom, and we'll see that in chapter 19. And again, terrible decision. You know, an unhealthy environment for his family. You know, what happens to his family in chapter 19? His wife is turned into salt because she disobeys a direct command of the Lord. And what happens with his two daughters? They commit incest with him in order to keep the family name going. So again, the impact of the godless Sodomites in his life. Why would you go live in a city like Sodom? That's devoted to destruction. So just as the actions and decisions of Lot show his character, he's not very mature, Abram's actions also show his character. He ends up in Canaan, and he that's where he dwells in the land of Canaan. He doesn't mix in with the Canaanites that are the inhabitants there. Okay, verse 13. Now the men of Sodom were evil and sinners, exceedingly so, against Yahweh. So again, the problem with Sodom and Gomorrah and the Jordan Valley wasn't the land, it was the people. And again, they were, I think NASB says, they were wicked exceedingly and sinners against the Lord. Again, looking forward to what's going to happen in chapter 19. And their evil nature parallels what happened in the days of the flood. You know, back in chapter 6, verse 5, about the days of Noah, how wicked, you know, wickedness just characterized all of the earth. And the same statement in chapter 8, verse 21. You know, the world at the time of the flood was corrupt, and what happened? It was wiped out. Well, guess what? The Jordan Valley cities, Sodom and Gomorrah, they're totally corrupt and they're wiped out. Again, with just the one surviving family out of that. Okay, verse 14. And Yahweh said to Abram after Lot had separated from him, "Now lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward and southward and eastward and westward. For all the land that you see, I will give it to you and to your seed forever. And I will make your seed as the dust of the earth, so that if anyone can number the dust of the earth, then your seed can also be numbered. Arise, walk about the land through its length and breadth, for I will give it to you." So again, God speaks after the separation. God speaks again to Abram and reconfirms his covenant promise. You know, again, after he separates from Lot. So this great assurance to, you know, Abram sitting there. So if I take in that lush valley, it'd be better. And so, no, God appears. You're following me. I'm going to give you these things. Again, that emphasis on I will in verse 15, and I will in verse 16, and I will in verse 17, just like we saw back in chapter 12 in those first three chapters. God is the one who is taking the initiative to ensure that his promises to Abraham will come to pass. And Abraham's told to look, to lift your eyes and look in verse 14. So what did, you know, it's in stark contrast to Lot. Lot lifted his own eyes and looked and took what he wanted. Well, God says, Abram, look, I'm going to do this. You're not doing this on your own. I'm the one who's doing this. Abram was waiting on God, whereas Lot just simply took things for himself. Now, like God's promise includes all the land that Abram can see in verse 15, all that he can walk in verse 17, and all the progeny he could ever count. It was kind of interesting. That's a problem with computers these days. It was calculating, okay, his progeny are going to be like the dust of the land. So how much dust is there in the land of Canaan? So then you can calculate that out and all the particles of dust. And it came out. Don't hold me accountable to these numbers, but this is like one rendition of how much that would be. It came out to 100 sextillion particles of dust would have been cover Canaan. So it's like you get into those numbers and it's like, what does that mean? But that would be equivalent to having 18.6 million people per square foot on the face of the earth. So obviously this is hyperbole. He's exaggerating to make a point. Unless the earth gets much bigger, he's talking about, you know, that there's just going to be massive numbers of progeny. There's not going to be 18.6 million descendants of Abram in every square foot of land on earth, but there are going to be a lot, innumerable. You know, if you went to count all the specks of dust in Canaan, that would be, it'd be eternity before you finished. So, and exactly how this is all going to, and also too, we'll see that in chapter 15, verse 5, he's going to say that, you know, his progeny will be likened to the stars in the sky. That's uncountable too for us. Or the sand on the seashore in chapter 22. So like the dust on the ground, the same thing. And that same promise regarding progeny is going to be passed on to Isaac and Jacob later on. You know, how this will happen is left unexplained, you know, because Sarai is still barren, and they're in there, you know, by this time, she's getting close to, you know, approaching 70-ish, and she doesn't have any children yet. It's going to be 20 more years before they have children, and he's not in possession of any land. He doesn't own any land. The whole time Abram's in Canaan, in the Old Testament, he owns one piece of land, and it's the burial plot at the cave at Machpelah. So again, this is all based on faith. He has no idea how it's going to come to pass. So verse 18, then Abram moved his tent and came and lived by the oaks of Mamre, which are in Hebron, And there he built an altar to the Lord. So again, the chapter closes just like it opened, with Abram worshiping the Lord, believing that his promises would come to pass by his own actions, by God's own actions. So we'll go ahead and stop there, and I'll let Tom, did you have anything else you wanted to say, Tom? Yeah, so stick around, and if you're interested in asking questions about the trip, which should be a great trip. I'm not sure who has seen and who hasn't seen the Ark, but it is an awesome thing. So we'll go ahead and end there. Thank you.